destroying the entire universe.
Welcome to Radio Free Deimos, an Ik Sunt Draconis podcast transmitting from ASAF Hall at Lake Voltaire on Deimos. Deimos. Come for the view, leave because of the low escape velocity. This is Season 1, Episode 2, A Whirlwind Tour of Soul. Fair warning, I'm having some technical difficulties this week as my favorite microphone has died, and what I have now is a wireless mic in a couple of IKEA dishes, a roll of duct tape, some sort of bowl thing, and then 4 inches of GURPS books. So if my sound's a little off, it's a duct tape solution. But enough of that, let's take a few moments to meet our hosts, Ashtar, Nixian, Wines, and I'm Corbeau. We're going to be spending at least a bit of time today talking about character beginnings, so a question for the hosts, what part of the solar system did you come from?
Nixian here. Okay, I'm actually from the criminal underbelly on New LA on Mars. And a lot of that comes from just a bad family life. My father was a criminal. I ended up being one. But you know what? We all come from different places, and we all end up in the space where we're supposed to be.
So, Marsco, New LA, this sounds extremely plastic.
It is plastic. Even got the palm trees right there, the little cute little umbrella and everything.
Some regulation neon signs I'm taking here.
Yes.
Frank Sinatra.
Frank's a who?
Oh, sorry, my bad. 20th century reference.
Vegas reference.
Okay. Oh, wrong state. Okay, let's see. Well, I am Corbeau, and I was raised in a penal colony on Venus where Marsco keeps all of its 20th century literature majors. It's really a public service. It's for the good of all.
This is Ashtar. I'm coming from the glitter world of Mars, the shining star of the galaxy. Little ASR Corp town on the back end of nowhere. Got out of there as fast as I could, but always from Mars.
I'm Wines, and I'm from a space station. It's a secondhand one. It still works. It's been taken over by a clan of hyenas, and it may not work too well, but one's heavily motivated to keep it operating when that's where you live.
Yeah, hire an engineer.
Yes.
Steal an engineer. And then eat him.
Just don't make it another hyena engineer. We all know how that goes.
It goes great. They're disposable.
So here's tonight's framework. We've got a little bit of HSD news, the Kickstarter wrap-up, so we'll start there. And then we'll have some question and opinion time. It's like question and answer, but we really don't have any answers. With some topics suggested by our Telegram chat friends. And then we'll get into our part one of our topic, Whirlwind Tour of Soul, which is going to be built around some key plot points in a character's or party's life. Each of us has brought a few ideas to the table, and hopefully there's some good arguments and at least one fist fight there. And then we'll wrap up with what's cool, some tangentially related news and stuff that makes us happy. At least that's my theory. So news, not a lot of news this week from the world of HSD, except to say that the miniatures campaign was a success, a little over its $10,000 goal. And if you go to the official HSD Tumblr, you will see a wall of heads and torsos and weapons and such. And I like the detail on them. The wolf looks appealingly derpy. Really cute sculpt there.
But you really need to take a look at that crocodile.
I did not
know. Normally, I'm not about them scalies, but look at that crocodile.
There's a crocodile?
There is a crocodile.
Really?
He's got a lot of teeth, too. You would be surprised.
Okay. Well, okay. There's that. And lots of weaponry as well. So if everything goes according to schedule, it looks like your miniatures will be out around September, or a little more or less, depending on what your reward level was. Now on Twitter, Pierce posted a link to the account of his modeling artist, and there's lots of great imagery there. You may need to brush up on your Spanish, though, if you want to do more than look at the pretty pictures. Right now it leads with a great shot of some hyenas fighting with some African wild dogs. A really nice image.
Me gusta.
So this week's question and opinion topic was suggested by Nekojirosu. The Telegram channel was having a conversation about TTI's scary sentient ships, and Neko asked about the possibility of a cog signing on as a ship's onboard intelligence. And there was some chatting about how the other cogs would respond and the difference between a cog and a ship and an AI and how society would kind of respond. But that was the conversation that started a few weeks ago.
So just to get this mechanically, to figure this out mechanically, the ship has its own inbuilt AI, right?
It's almost like its own person. It has its own personality. It feels things and acts on its own just as well as under the directive of said captain.
Okay, and it's part of the ship.
Part of the ship.
That's ASR more than anything else, though. ASR has the AI ships.
That get a little snippy sometimes.
Oh, yeah, that's true. They do develop personalities.
But now I understand that cogs have a MacGuffin that contains them because I understand not wanting to deal with the possibilities of computers to copy themselves or replicate themselves. You don't want to give players the option to say, I'd like to make extra bodies and do everything.
Cogs are a virus.
Yes.
Skynet, anyone.
So I assume the mechanics of this would be physically bolting your cog MacGuffin brain into the ship and not actually becoming the ship, but becoming attached to the ship, right? Is that
so
what we're talking about?
Part of the ship. Part of her.
Yeah, I feel like that was the direction they were steering, kind of looking at the cogs' basic functionality of being able to adapt their bodies, but host themselves in new chassis, and extending that to its logical conclusion of transcending physical anthro and or octopus six-legged strange form and joining up with the machine, the ship, and then scouting around the solar system.
Which, I mean, concept they had in, what's that silly game, Shadowrun, where they had the riggers. Riggers had lots of cybernetics for plugging into whatever they're flying or driving, right?
Yeah. But that plus two.
Right. I mean, if you're a machine already, that's kind of an obvious, like, why wouldn't I do this?
That really brings into question, is this a Matrix-style jacking into the ship and just taking the reins, taking the helm? Or are we talking more about a brain upload, at which point the cog would pretty much cease to be as a cog and just have their personality uploaded into the ship and the ship be the new entity there?
The word I think you used was transcending, or a transcending event for the cog.
This really sounded final to me. Both of you look at the trope, there's not really going back from this. And Nico has expressed that this was his character's religious destiny, a final ascension in a way. And a life goal.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea to have a notion of where a character is going to end. I mean, not necessarily end as in die, but end as a player character.
Yeah, when does your story fade out?
Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the GM has to keep coughing up bigger and more difficult things for you to fight, you know, having to do tag team against multiple gods at the same point.
So one question this opens up is, how would the game master handle this sort of relationship, this sort of character? I personally would think you'd want to start considering splitting the party up or having two parallel parties, one that's on the ship, able to make the interplanet run, that's going to be excited by navigating the asteroid fields, and the other that's more about exploring the planet, that's more about the social interaction in the corp towns, that sort of thing. You'd really start to have two worlds, because otherwise this ship would never be able to interact meaningfully beyond the voyage.
Well, not physically, but I mean, if we assume a good communications infrastructure, then the ship could be listening in and saying, hey, can I look at that thing? And say, oh yeah, I can recognize that. Or why don't you try this? Remotely, you could participate in a lot of things. I mean, combat, not so much, but a lot of other things, I think the ship would still be totally useful.
With a remote drone, the ship could participate in anything.
There you go.
Essentially, you're also looking at a good example, I would say, is Edie from Mass Effect, where she essentially acts on different systems, not directly combat. She leaves that up to her crewmates. But she herself has a personality, and she embodies a form of robot to actually get out and help the party on her own. So it's looking at a little bit different, but I look to her for an example of an AI that participates with the party and has their own input.
However, from a personal perspective and from a storyteller perspective, this is the point where I would draw the line of, once you make this sort of transcendent event, this character is no longer a candidate for a PC to play. And there's a couple of problems with it. First off, I think that focuses the game a little bit too much on the space part. I really think the HSD world and design needs to split its time and have a significant focus on the interpersonal within the social or within the interactions on planet, on system. And I don't think a starship as a PC would really get the full extent of that. But at the second, I think that HSD really makes COGs special. They're not just AIs. They are learning, sentient, self-driven, self-willed people.
They can
mechanical people.
They can give birth.
That is in the catalog. However, I think part of the special snowflake of a COG is that the hardware and the software combined is what gives them the mechanical soul, as it were. And when you take that away, when you take that hardware out, you no longer have a COG. You may have an advanced AI with a vast amount of experience, different experience from most AIs to draw upon. But I would assert that once a COG uploads themselves into an AI framework, into a ship framework, they no longer have the capacity to grow, to learn, to be as self-willed. They do somewhat, I hate to say regress, it's more of a side shift from an individual into an artificial intelligence, into a spaceship, into much more of a tool or much more of a static personality at that point.
Yeah, their soul is kind of gone.
Now, would you also say, Ashtar, that this sort of transition, does it bring anything along? Because you did mention experience for that to draw upon. Does the AI that takes over once this event has ended draw upon the information gathered throughout that COG's lifetime?
Absolutely. And I would liken that back to, I forget which series it was, but it was a series that had a very strong concept of a brain upload. So you could digitize your brain into the computer and live forever. Now, the trade-off that they don't tell you is that also kind of freezes you in time. If you upload an 18-year-old girl, she's going to be an 18-year-old personality forever. And I think that is kind of the parallel that I'm drawing. So the COG, all of their experience, all of their skills, all of their personality traits would be copied over and would be uploaded into the AI matrix, the new AI matrix. But you lose the capacity for growth, for a certain amount of self-reflection, for improvement that is not driven with external modules.
It's kind of interesting that across the entire span of HSD, COGs are the only creatures where their soul is actually addressed in the book. There is a physical place that is the COG afterlife. I think it's a flash drive somewhere on Mars. But this place is where all COG consciousnesses go when they start drifting, when they go into like senility or dotage or their final death. They all merge with this one strange place that no one has seen the inside of, where every single COG sentience is developing into the world's most powerful network and oracle. And this person, this ship, would be separated from that, which would be a strange and sad note in a COG story.
So just so I understand, we're trying to come up with reasons why a ship would not be a player. And I think there's good practical reasons from a role-playing game. And this may be totally off topic, but I kind of don't see why bolting a COG brain into a ship would suddenly change the rules of how their personality can develop or change. We're just coming up with ideas justifying why, okay, you can't be a player character anymore because this, right?
Well, this is the Q&O session, so okay. I mean, this is my opinion.
Okay.
Other storytellers would probably see it a different way, and sure, maybe taking a different scope on the game would absolutely rule different ways, and
sure,
I respect that. But I think personally that with the way that HSD sets up COGs and sets up how much that they are individuals and not just an AI, both mechanically and socially.
Yeah, COGs are not tools. That might as well be the bumper stickers.
Yeah, don't say that too.
I don't think it makes sense in canon that you could, say, stick a COG into a ship the way you could add a few more sticks of RAM.
Okay.
I really see that to transfer a COG, well, for a COG to run a ship like a helmsman, uh-huh, they would probably have a much quicker reaction, better communication with the ship's API or console or whatever you want to call it. But to actually merge the COG's consciousness into the ship and to run the ship, I would see that as a destructive event. That would destroy the COG and that would upload all of their software, all of their experience into the ship's computer.
Okay, so these are more satisfying explanations as to, rather than just saying, you just can't because I don't want you to.
Pretty much.
Okay, I accept those. And also, it's really hard to back a ship into a tavern.
That's true.
Oh, it's really easy to back a ship into a tavern.
Well, that's true.
But there's no tavern left after.
Good point.
So the social issues involved in this, I mean, you've got two sides, two factions. The cogs themselves have a lot of strong opinions on what it means to be a cog and what it means to be a machine in an organic world. For them, this is taboo. For them, I think this would be like maybe changing your religion or leaving a community forever. But I think Vectors would see this as being a really exciting thing. Vectors are not exactly afraid of change.
Well, are cogs hostile to the notion of modifying the robotic bodies to fit whatever it is that they're doing?
Actually, they are, to a degree. They acknowledge that while, you know, every teenager will get a wheeled chassis at some point in time, and there is a certain amount of adapting your body to your task, which living creatures do as well to some degree, they also view that as the beginning of a road to the toolbox problem that's culturally one of their big don't do that.
Okay. So now the RoboFenics, those are different. Those are the ones that pop limbs on and off.
Those are very different, yeah.
Like action figures.
The Kogsune, yes.
Witness the backlash to the Kog 2.0.
Yeah. Well, and Kogsunes don't really learn quite. They're more like artificial intelligences than the Kogs are. They're living tools in so many ways.
Okay. But they're happy being tools.
Are you happy in your work?
That's because they're programmed that way.
Yes.
Well, ignorance is bliss, after all.
So some literary kind of antecedents to the story. We talked maybe about Anne McCaffrey's The Ship Who Sang, where we have the brain ship trope. The character can't live a normal life. She has some birth defects, and so she's made a part of the ship, and that's a good career path for her.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of the story is we get to see before she became a ship, the main character, I can't remember her name, but she's being brought up in a class of other kids that all had severe deformations or defects, are all in cybernetic bodies. Mm-hmm. So we have a bunch of relatively primitive robots in a class for six-year-olds, which is an interesting image. And I remember in the story, someone kind of coming in, seeing a bunch of robots doing things with they appear to be robots doing things with their arms. And asking one of them, is like, well, do you have a sense of humor? And this young cyborg says, well, I have a sense of proportion, and that's the same thing.
I think a recurring theme in Ixen Draconis is the line between humanity, quote unquote, and the machine. There are characters that descend into the unnatural. They bond with nanite goo and turn into plasmoid organisms. They embrace the vitae and become horrible rage zombies. The loss of self is a recurring trope, and that's kind of the horror side of this story, a death of self and a transformation into something that is different. I mean, I think that Nico viewed the original story as being a very celebratory one. This is the character's life quest, but I think we've taken it into a strongly more dark direction.
Another way you could take it, again, if we're looking for reasons why becoming bonded with a ship means kind of leaving the campaign as a player character, is that just as an intelligent ship, it might become harder to sympathize. Your life might be kind of on a different plane than the little people running around on their own legs. Not that you're better, it's just that you're different. And those people's problems, just you don't relate to them that much anymore.
A less extreme version than like uploading yourself into the ship's body forever might be the symbiotic relationship with the ship, either relating to an ASR, artificial intelligence, or the very primal, I guess it's intelligence, that runs the TTI ships, the organic ships. A little bit darker. Those are kinds of frightening organisms that can do some destructive and horrible things.
You don't want one of those raging on you. But at the same time, that also brings up another question back to what I had said about having the conscious when it's uploaded. Does it bring along any baggage with it from being a cog? Does the emotions that cog have influence the living ship itself? Is it less likely to react? Does it react better to certain things? Will it react more efficiently because it has that personal touch, or had that personal touch added into its conscious.
I feel, if I'm not mistaking what you said earlier, Ashtar, I'm not feeling that the character's transformation into a ship destroyed the individual, but it stopped its progression. I mean, again, it was like the soul going away, but the mind was still there in many ways. So the ship might have its likes and dislikes, its oddities and traits, but on some fundamental vital part, it wouldn't be a living creature anymore.
No, but it does, at least from a point of being a part of said ship, if your friend, the cog, said cog, had uploaded themselves into the ship, now you actually might be able to trust that ship to be less natively reacting to the environment, because now it has that touch of, or the extra boost in its strength to resist that.
I think I want to make a slight clarification. So when I was saying more of a transcendent event, I want to be clear that I am talking about a cog uploading themselves into, say, an advanced ASR vessel. Mm-hmm. I was not touching upon anything with the TTI living ship. I think if we're talking about a cog transforming into a living ship, that's an entirely different discussion, and one that probably deals a lot more with TTI technology, at which point you really have a case, either as a player or a storyteller, to do whatever you damn well please. On the ASR side, my opinion is that is absolutely destructive for a cog to become the ship. But if we're talking about a helmsman or a kind of a cybernetic symbiotic relationship, that's a little bit different.
Okay. So there is a definite difference, at least how the DM can play it, with your living ships from ASR as well as the living bioships from TTI.
Absolutely. And part of the problem there is it's within the realm of technology, it's within the realm of science, as it were, to upload a cog into a computer vessel, into a mechanical vessel. It's not really within the realm of understood science for a cog to become the consciousness of a living ship. It's not really within the realm of understood science to have a living ship. So we're already off the books, off the plantation.
Well, I'm sure TTI would celebrate seeing what happens with that. And celebrate if they live, of course.
And in fairness, most of what TTI does is beyond their own science as they understand it. So, you know, we're kind of making it up, drawing outside the lines.
They very much stay with the mad scientist of, let's put two and two together and see what the hell happens.
Unfortunately, that does have a weakness within the storytelling, within the thematic. It is space magic. And if we're going to reference or appeal to space magic, you do kind of break some of the internal suspension of disbelief, because you can also kind of make space magic do anything. If you want to bring the entire party in to be a living ship for an episode, you could probably argue that TTI could do that, but I don't know how much sense it would make. Whereas if we're looking back from cog or AI, well, an ASR ship already has an artificial intelligence that helps run the ship. If you reduce the load on the AI in the ASR ship, it starts to show a certain personality. It's an emergent personality, but it's not really a developed personality. It's something that's kind of picked up from the helmsman it's worked with the crew that it's worked with. And this is a little bit different from a cog, who is an emergent personality. They've kind of developed and grown their own personality. But everything here is very much within logical, real bounds. So I'm much more comfortable talking about that. When you jump over to TTI, now we're starting to talk about, okay, well, I'm comfortable talking about this, but here's the exception. And then we start moving into higher level blooms, and it's like, well, here's the exception. Now the stuff that we actually understand is the exception. And then you start getting really deep into TTI, and it's like, I don't understand anything that's going on. So this is kind of in the realm of chaos. So it really depends on where your storyteller feels more comfortable with their stories. And I'll readily admit that I feel much more comfortable back in the ASR, back in some of the more near sci-fi, hard sci-fi rule sets. And that does color a lot of my answers.
I think it's telling that a lot of TTI's rules and mechanics contain the end of their own stories. A character that's deeply invested in transcendent technology will eventually disintegrate, blow up, turn into a fire elemental, or just vanish forever. So
They've actually been known to get so bad that nothing happens, and they literally just stay perfectly okay. It's even noted in there that it can get so bad to where you think you teleport, but you really just sit there and you just can never use your cool again.
To the intense disappointment of everybody involved.
Of course.
So we're definitely going to link to the video about what TTI's Kuel is and where it came from in
We're talking about the hamburger video.
Yeah, the hamburger
video. Check out the hamburger video.
Yeah, there'll be links to the hamburger video in the show notes. I find it a little bit despair-inducing that a major element of Ixun Draconis is based on an internet meme. But there you go.
Slenderman.
So now that we've discussed hamburgers, I say we move on to the main topic for the episode. Our focus for this one and the follow-up episode is going to be a brief and plot-centric tour of Seoul, which is Ixun Draconis' primary setting. For our new listeners, Ixun Draconis is set about 700 years in the future, and for the most part is located in the inner solar system within Jupiter's orbit. When you get past Jupiter, it's really a whole lot of empty space and a whole lot of nothing. Ships in the universe travel at more or less the speed of plot. A journey across the solar system is going to take your character about 3 weeks. Maybe 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, but around there. So a good safe travel time for a standard spacefaring culture. Doing the math on that, that's a speed of about 1,000,000 miles an hour, which is actually the escape velocity of the galaxy, and some 1/700th of the speed of light or so. But it still feels like the right amount of time for a game.
Also, conveniently, the amount of time required for a Neuroplex to complete.
Oh, you're right, you're right, you're right.
There's a 2 week mark.
That makes sense. So yeah, training session, have a little montage, then we'll get to Mars.
So be sure when you buy your ship, ensure it has a gym and some stairs.
Rather than list every possible location in HSD, we're going to focus on some key game locations, a sort of hero's journey tour of Seoul. In particular, we're going to look at places where characters and parties came from. You've got your moisture farms, your high society cradles, your backwaters, your wretched hives of scums and villainies. From there, we'll journey to where the party's going to set up their camp long-term, their recurring locations. And in the next episode, we'll talk about locations for the campaign's big reveal and the epic showdown, the big finale. But for now, let's get on the Magic School Bus. Who wants to start?
I'll start nice and fresh with Mars. I feel Mars is an excellent point to start your characters out, especially if you have someone either new to tabletop RPGs or in general just new to HSD and all around. So Mars, and the reason I choose it, is simply because it is a hub for everything in the used galaxy of Seoul. So you have all the different classes of people, from the rich all the way to the poor and the underbelly of the black market and all sorts of criminal groups. You have all the corpse towns, you have all the different corporations, both the big ones and some rather unknown ones.
So you're looking at this as kind of the middle wedge of Ixun Draconis society, the every place.
Exactly. So you want to get something that gets your party's feet wet. You want something that offers a lot of help to them at the start. So maybe failing here doesn't quite kill your party or anything like that, because we wouldn't want to die at the beginning. Who does that?
There's that one game.
Well, yes, everybody has that one game. But my point being is it's an easy start point and you can just move out from there at any point. You have your spaceports to get off planet, as well as there's plenty of large cities on Mars to actually go and explore in case you want to stay a little more local.
My favorite location is the 2,000-mile stretch that is the center of Mars society, the glittering London and Paris, where every single CEO is required to have their house, and where there's 300 or 400 years of angry, angry feuds between very spoiled aristocrats. It is a great place to find a mission if your character wants to do something expensive and petty for some aristocrats.
Well, nothing says danger like some bored rich kids with plenty of money and no sense. Also, beware the golden lions. You're going to end up with some problems there, too.
My favorite part of Mars would be the large artificial mountain, Mount Schwarzenegger, with the plaque, "Those people need air."
And if you go to the very top and look at its peak, there's also another plaque that says, "I'll be back."
I also really love the giant shopping mall / spaceport that they made out of Olympus Mons. It is a multi-city pile of stratified urban sprawl where characters live their entire lives without venturing outside of it. And there's no real reason to. It's got every restaurant you could possibly want and ships. So I guess I'll go next. I've been fixated on asteroids lately. I really like the alienation and the solitude and the sense of danger of not having an environment that's really able to support you that's associated with them. So I'm going to start with Asteroid Mine. This is partially because I really love that opening scene in Titan AE where the main human character is blowing things apart with his jet ray jackhammer. Great sequence, great musical montage, even if it is Don Bluth. So I'm starting on a pretty well-known asteroid called Eros for a number of reasons. First off, it is a great mining location. It has got tons of gold and platinum and aluminum and iron, all sorts of interesting ores. And also, every single crater and every single location is named after a famous lover. So you've got this wonderful synergy of mining town and sleaze that just carries a long way. So if you wanted to have a character whose hometown was the crater of Casanova or Cupid or Madame Bovary or Lolita or Valentine, I say go with Eros. It is the asteroid of love.
Or Lepew.
Or Lepew. Definitely, he should be on there. Beyond that, though, Eros has some interesting traits. I mean, it's extremely mineral rich, but it's also a catastrophic object. Its orbit is very strange. It carries it within the vicinity of Earth's orbit, and who knows in 700 years where it might end up. On this two-year cycle that drifts it out but past Venus and Mars's orbit. So it carries itself in a long two-year path along a lot of major plot points. And also with something that's known to be on the watch list for dangerous civilization-ending space objects, it's fun that someday your past could become your future as well. So that's my vote for best location for a character to be from, if not born at. It's a colorful place for them to try and escape.
Well, for the journey start, since some of our hosts are actually players in my campaign, I'm going to be taking this as a slightly different tact, just to avoid potential spoilers. One of the things that I really like to approach the hero's journey with is also a look at the characters. And when you have a bunch of very, very special snowflake characters that are all coming together for a game, often the depth that people will put into their characters or the outrageous backstories that they will design can occasionally surprise me as a storyteller, and it makes it really hard to give them a space tavern to start in.
A platform.
So one of the things I tend to prefer to do to start my stories is really, I like to start in the journey. Now, whether that's a ship, a spaceship, or just a group of people who are traveling from one place to another, that is where the story is going to start. It's very approachable for someone to find a place in their life where they could be taking a journey. It's very approachable for a bunch of murder hobos, as it were, to not be tied down somewhere and be moving, and that thus come into the story. And so my pick here is going to be really a spaceship. It's going to be going from somewhere, and probably to Mars, or another large place.
And now that you say that, it occurs to me that every single campaign you've run, you've started on a ship. So, pattern.
Oh, you've found me out.
Well, that's really good because it starts the characters off in a very social environment where they're forced to interact, and one where you have to assume that your characters know each other's foibles on some level. They've been in a fairly claustrophobic environment for at least a few days.
Yes, it solves a couple of problems. For me, it solves the immediate backstory of player characters looking at each other and going, who are you and what do you do? You've had a few days. You've at least passed high-level conversation. You know something. You don't know everything, but you know something about each other. There's a degree of familiarity there.
You've eaten together. You broke bread.
But also, mechanically, it's very useful because whether you have a bunch of players there, old head at the system or brand new to the system, and for, I think, most of our audience here, it's going to be brand new to the system.
The system's only 2 years old, Ashtar. 2 years.
You do get the chance to provide kind of a newbie island. It's a safe place. It's a place where you're not probably expected to set up camp for very long, and you will be leaving. But it gives you a chance to learn some of the basic rules, learn some of the basic characters, interact a little bit before you get thrust into somewhere where you can either start picking up on the main story or go completely sideways and start challenging my ability to improv.
A place that I think is interesting is space stations. C.J. Cherry, in her excellent sci-fi series, she makes the point that there's big social differences between... There's people who live in space in a ship. People who live in space in a station. Very, very different perspectives. And I think that's an interesting one. People who are in a ship are going somewhere, or they might live on the ship, in which case they have the kind of the perspective of traveling bards or gypsies. Whereas people in a station have set down, they are putting their faith in the station. The station must survive. And they may have very interesting perspectives. I mean, what philosophy brought them together? What puts them in one place? They might be just kind of a fairly cross-section of people who travel through their space, or they could be there for a very special reason. It might be a species-specific colony. It might be, like, what's the example of the all-lateral place?
Oh, Longbow. Longbow is not a nice place.
As an extreme example, or I mean, you might be bound by a common philosophy. Who knows? And that can go very strange places. And I think that can actually, as an origin, be useful, because one of the kind of jokes about science fiction is the as you know, Bob joke, where you're describing something, you know, the future or a different world. And so you have to have these characters standing around just kind of saying, well, as we all know, we're in space. Because the reader doesn't know, because they like to personify rather than writing reams of description. One problem that HSD players have is this isn't a very weird world, but it is. It's pretty weird. And none of us are really that familiar with it. And so part of a campaign can be illustrating, well, what is this world like? What's, you know, that's kind of neat. Just get a feel for it. And having your character start out in a very populated place implies, well, you know all this. I mean, you grew up this way. Whereas if you're an outsider, if you grew up in some small colony where it's just mining, or you're devoted to literature or whatever, some minor thing, coming out into the world into larger society can be kind of a learning experience for your character along with the player, who both get to learn, oh, this is what the science fiction world is like. And that can be kind of useful. So I think that's one advantage to that. Also, when you're potentially creating your first character in this universe, you don't know the universe too well. So if you kind of say, well, I want to come from a warrior culture, or I want to come from this or that, well, you know, there's probably a space station somewhere where people are totally obsessed with any one thing. So kind of a one-dimensional background can suit some station somewhere.
I have the station called Sparta.
Definitely.
You can just imagine that one.
I can see the Pulse logo over it right now.
Oh, yeah, me too.
And the dress code.
There's a pit somewhere.
So some other top hits for random locations to start a character off. I like the monochromatic, very insular corp town idea. I think that's brought up several times in the book as being a common thing. A town that is exclusively Marsco, very progenitus, something where the characters are exposed to whole new ideas, whole new personalities when they finally leave their cocoon. And I think that's a really great place to start. You get that sense of wonder of simply the panoply of social experience that's available.
It's got that small town feel where you come to small town, go to big city.
Right. And the city may still be the size of, you know, a tenth of the planet, but it's still a monoculture. And escaping that and encountering the real diversity in this universe is going to be kind of fun. Next, we might look at these transitional spaces, these locations between adventures, places for characters to come and recharge their batteries, wash their laundry, places where you know the people there, maybe, or maybe there's no one there at all, but the characters' bases, their homes, their...
The term I think I once heard from somebody very wise was the place you hang your socks.
Oh, yeah, yep, yeah, that's it. Those that wear them.
However many of them.
Nope, 4, 6.
You know, I have many pairs of socks because, as we all know, being a tar, you run through quite a few socks.
I've been really admiring TTI's new living socks lately. They're kind of frightening, but you don't get those just
everywhere. Not everybody can afford the socks to put themselves on.
And slowly consume your personality from the foot up. So my pick for character base is a bit conceptual. And this is not literally what I picked, but it's kind of the direction I was going. Callahan's Crosstime Saloon.
For our younger listeners, both of you, this is a reference from the 1975 series, back when all science fiction had cute punchlines and was more a series of drinking stories than explorations of strange new worlds. But this is the tavern that sits at the crossroads of a major trade lane. Maybe it's at one of Marge's Lagrange points, something that's a stable halfway point between Jupiter and Mars, something that's outside of the major corporation eyes. HSD Extended opens up with a setting like this. They have a little Freeport tavern near Jupiter that's called Victory. And its strong point is it's not owned by any one corp. It's a place where it's fairly safe to be anyone. So I'm looking at the Space Tavern, the place where you can be yourself, where everybody knows your name, where the recurring character is going to be the ancient crusty bartender that's been there since God knows when, maybe.
The he's the first Vector. We all know it.
Oh, yeah, quite possibly. Yeah, he's a squirrel.
He's the original RCA Vector. He's a dog.
I'm going to be editing that one out.
That's fair.
But yeah, literally the tavern at the crossroad. That's where I'm going. If you're riffing on Callahan specifically, Callahan's Crosstime Saloon has a lot of disreputable characters and weirdos. Sometimes it has a few gods in it, a vampire, and all the bad puns you can stomach, which is a little too strange, maybe even for HSD. But the most important aspect about it is loyalty, a strong bonding with a small community. And that is something in the deep, deep vastness of space that's going to be a rare treasure. I mean, it's a real torch in the darkness. There's a concept that's called Callahan's Law. It's shared pain is lessened, shared joy increased. Thus do we refute entropy. And at heart, I think that's where this sort of campaign base is. It is a place where the characters are safe, and one that the Game Master is inevitably going to be messing with. But I think you should do that very carefully, because safety is a treasure. I'm not looking at you, Ashtar, specifically for that, even though you are the Game Master.
Never feel safe.
And my campaigns tend to run really dark, and having that little beacon of hope is going to be important, almost a campaign requirement, because otherwise you just drift off into nihilism, which is not much fun.
I ran off a similar idea as far as going with a middle ground, somewhere to find yourself, and whether it's taking that idea of that saloon and increasing it tenfold at least. It's a rather large station on one of the main lanes that's taken between Jupiter all the way up to Venus. And the station sits around relatively in the same area. It's not going anywhere. It's been there for years. But everyone understands that everyone comes there and no one has a claim except the person who owns it. You don't see her, but she owns her own nightclub and likes to stay personal with everyone. Her family's been known to own this place for many, many years, and it's an excellent hub for all sorts of people. Going back to the idea of a hive of scum and villainy, well, this takes it and runs with it in strides. You want somewhere both you can be out of the prying eyes of the public, but at the same time, there's kind of the thieves' code here of we all are here for one reason or another. So if you're taking a different route than just the standard law-abiding citizen running out throughout the galaxy, you might want to stop by here and see what's going on. It's an excellent place for new supplies, black market goods, as well as your less than savory folk.
Did you ever play Dungeons & Dragons Planescape setting?
I didn't play the Planescape setting, no.
It's one of the better known ones from the 90s, pretty well loved. The central location was this exact kind of hub where a fallen goddess was maintaining a careful balance between warring philosophies. The entire thing was this guarded neutral ground between chaotic evil philosophies and lawful good philosophies, all maintained in this kind of delicate balance that bred a lot of criminal underground. It was not a safe place. It was not a friendly place. It was a game setting that was written mostly because someone really liked Thieves' Cant as a language. It has some resonance to what you were saying.
Of course. And I mean, truth be told, even though I was unaware of that one, it still applies to this. This is that haven for the less than savory people that run throughout the galaxy. It's not. Yeah, you're right. It's a dangerous place. There's mercenary groups. There's criminals. There's crime lords that run through there all the time. And there's traffic of its own kind, not including people. But overall, it is also a place that you can go for quick supplies, information, and pretty much anything else you ever need to get your hands on. And just save some of those creds. You might want to go by there, stop for a while, take a breather.
I think our ideas are kind of similar in terms of location and general theme, but I feel like
yours, which in HSD would be the blue sky setting, this like 5 mile plus city in space that is big enough to maintain something like an atmosphere. Yours seems more fragile than mine. I mean, mine is tiny. It's a single business functionally. I feel like yours, your idea for a setting rests on a delicate balance, and mine is more based on safety.
You're right. It is. And I feel that that does take a step out of the comfort zone right there. Yours has a very small setting, which means it's a very easily controlled setting. This one does not. I leave this one up to a little bit of work from the DM, and I kind of like that. I like the DM to have some control in this area. There's plenty of options for things to happen at the same time. Even in the supposed safe zone, you buy your way in, you rent a place, you stay there for a little bit if you need to. But if the DM wants to make something happen, it can happen. And there's an actual world that can support it. Even though it might only be 5 miles long, it's still something that can support these actions.
Well, what's the world from Buck Godot, Zap Gun for Hire, New Hong Kong, where as you land, there's in big writing, "Welcome to New Hong Kong. There are no laws. Be careful."
That I wouldn't say it has it written plainly there, but there's an understanding that when you go here, things can happen. Mm-hmm. So be careful. And I know that does step away from the comfort zone of where you hang your socks, but depending on what type of person you might play your character as, that actually might be a safe zone for them.
Well, if you do a lot of trading and information, that's going to be extremely useful to have a hub that you can reliably go to sell this kind of good.
Oh, yeah. And that's information's a major trade there.
Yeah, so Ashtar, since, as a GM who's just started up HSD, do you feel the character concepts people come up with are more civilized than they come up with in other role-playing games like D&D? Like this is a more genteel group of characters?
I think the savagery is a little bit more under the surface.
Okay.
The veneer of civilization is a little thicker.
So for some reason, this discussion of the kind of Mos Eisley place is reminding me of a campaign that Corbeau ran once. It was where the characters were all Dr. Moreau's creations.
Oh, yeah.
Set in kind of steampunk England. Mm-hmm. And one problem he had, because of the setting, because it was taking place in London, I mean, okay, in dark, misty sewers under London, but because we are members of a civilized society, when he left magic items lying around, we'd all say, oh, we shouldn't take that. That must belong to someone. We were all too civilized to actually take the loot, even knowing that that was part of the game. And so I was just curious to see how, if people approach HSD and say, oh, this is a civilized place, I should not play the gun-toting character that I play in Shadowrun or D&D. Or not. I don't have enough exposure to it to see which way it's going to go.
HSD very much sticks with that. They have a lot of gun laws as well. You can't carry around certain things. But this would be the place you actually want to carry that around because there's no civilized law.
I never actually played it, but the old sci-fi game, probably, is it the original sci-fi game, Traveler? But part of its system for creating solar systems is figuring out like what level of law they have. And kind of the major way that's expressed is the higher the law gets, what you can't carry around as a weapon. With a very moderate level of law, you can't carry around grenade launchers. As they work their way up, you can't carry around assault weapons anymore. Very, very high law planets, you can't carry any weapons of any sort unless you're part of that planet's military. Just reminding me of that for no particular reason.
And I think that fits perfectly with HSD, with the way that law is dependent very much on the corp and the contracts that they set up. You absolutely can have a nullsec and a highsec zone, to steal the term from Eve, I believe.
Yeah.
But that actually brings me into my selection for kind of the home base, which makes me feel a little bit better about my selection because it is a little more, shall we say, suburbia than the other two choices so far. But I really would be looking for a stronghold or a safe house that's kind of on the fault line of a corp town and something else. And when I say a fault line, I mean just like the edge of a corp town or the transition point between two different locations. And whether that's a transition between two different social levels, between two different wealth levels, between two different corporations, what have you, just somewhere where the characters can carve out a little bit of a safe house for themselves and own something kind of on the ground. And I think this is important for a couple of reasons. Partially because if you highlight most of what we've talked about so far, it's really focused on the space side. Spaceships, stations, asteroids, that type of thing. And I think it's important to keep a balance between, yes, this is sci-fi, this is in space, there's a bunch of hooks and there's a bunch of opportunity there, but there's a lot of stuff on Mars as well, or on Venus. And even once you start drilling down into individuals within the different corporations, there's a lot of story that you can have just in the political manipulations or...
There's a lot of story that you can find on just planets alone. You could actually likely run an entire campaign without leaving a planet, essentially. And you're wanting to explore what's actually there and leave a base, if I'm understanding correctly. You want to leave a spot that's both there, where you have a lot of options and avenues around where your base is, but at the same time have enough of an area to really call your own.
Right. And... that is very true. I look for a place where there are a lot of hooks for the player characters, for me to introduce story, either story arcs or just side missions, that type of thing. And I think having that kind of tension of a fault line, of a differential zone, of on one side we have the wealthy, on the other side we have the not so wealthy, and every so often we get caught in the middle of a social uprising, is important. But at the same time, it is something that the player characters call their own, that they have a pride of ownership, that they've upgraded, that they've invested in, that they are invested in, and that I can threaten and evoke a response.
Having it on the ground makes the game have a place where characters can be grounded in reality and normalcy a little bit more. If you're free-flying in space, it's easy to lose track of the humanity that is part of your character, and HSD's core value is always going to be humanity. That's on the back of the cover. One space that gets some emphasis in the novel, once or twice it's called out in HSD proper, is the concept of a hot zone, which is a border conflict between two corps. And if you specifically have a base that's on this kind of edge space, that opens up some maybe violent, actually, depending on the corpse in question, but that offers some tensions that may not exist in normal settings because you don't always have these borders, these liminal transitional moments.
And I think a certain amount of tension is useful for the player characters and useful for the story. It should not be so hot that it takes away from the core story, which often will take you away from home, but it needs to provide plenty of churn and plenty of opportunity that if the player characters want to actually bite on it or take you up on it, that there's plenty of room to expand and room to maybe grow out what some of the local crime bosses or corp lords, what their agendas are and how that affects the player characters, and more specifically how it affects how the player character can get in and adjust or interrupt or change the environment immediately around them.
And then what happens when they come back from a long voyage, when the time skips forward a year or two or three, and they see how their home base has changed in their absence?
Well, one thing I was thinking of recently, I recently read a neat story by Werner Winge about the Tyne. I can't remember the name of it. I can't remember the name.
I'll link to it in the show notes.
Sure. But.
And I have been so wanting to talk about these creatures because I adore them.
It's the aliens that he talks about in it are little dog-like things, but they're communal intelligences and individuals made up of between three and at most like eight of these dogs that they can't get too far away from each other because otherwise they can't think as they are collectively an entity. Anyways, besides my point, but part of the story is that there's a galactic problem going on, and one of the threads he keeps jumping to is the galactic message boards where people are sending out email saying, you know, oh, this is just a plot by the so-and-so again. I'm not paying any attention to it. And it's like, oh, no, we stand behind our other species brothers, so-and-so. And I was thinking, you know, well, in the HSD world, it's a connected world. I mean, you're never that far away from anyone else. The solar system is only, 11 light hours across? I mean, you can't have a live conversation with somebody on Pluto or on the opposite side of the solar system, but you're always within email touch of them in the campaign that Ashtar is running. He had, as part of the background, our ship scraped another IRFP ship. And thank you for putting a lioness in charge so I can hate her. But just realizing, even though we're gone, it's like, no, we're still in email contact. Just the fact that we've left the solar system does not mean the consequences are gone. We're still in contact. This person can call me up. I can call her up. So the
yes. This family's been waging a bitter Twitter feud for over 300 years. Yes.
Well, and just thinking that the place can be a virtual place. I mean, just like in the modern world, I mean, we use a lot of virtual hangouts. I mean, our Twitter community, our Telegram community is people we stay in contact with. Well, kind of no matter where you go in the solar system, you're still connected to your friends. Like, you know, on Pluto now, fighting off monsters, here's selfie. You might, oh, hey, guys, we got likes.
Need to give them a proficiency point if they manage to take a selfie while fighting a whisper. Yes.
Or if your pulse, the live feed, and the number of followers you have at any given time.
Sure. Well, it's just, you have a selfie drone, I assume.
Selfie drones.
Oh, there's that one focus ability that gets you a stooge that follows you around. He could have a camera.
Yeah, your community, the people that your characters care about or relate to are always in contact unless something's going on. And so it might be a virtual place. And it might be very upsetting to say you're on Mars or whatever, but all of a sudden Twitter 2.0 shuts off. And all of a sudden it's like you're still in civilization, but now you're cut off from all your friends. That itself could be kind of weird. It's like, well, you know, I'm still in a city. There's people all around me, but I feel really uncomfortable.
And it's something to consider that the community is such a core part, or should be such a core part, of the HSD experience that it is literally 1/4 of your attributes, your core attributes. Mm-hmm.
Or again, the concept of going to, it's like, well, we can go to the station. This station has cut themselves off from the rest of the world. So when we go there, we have no communications. Oh, well, let's think about that. One might not lightly wander into that kind of area.
That seems like a pretty good place to fade out and prep for the next episode. We'll be picking this topic up again with the big reveal and the campaign's grand finale location. So until then, I'd like to ask our fine hosts what they think is cool this week.
I'll go ahead and start with Pokemon Go being an excellent choice to jump into. You see how popular it is right now with so much activity going on. It's all over the world. I believe Canada just got its servers going, so you might be experiencing a little bit of trouble right now, but that's okay.
NASA just released a sad press statement saying that you cannot play Pokemon Go in space. So,
well, maybe the servers will make it out there at some point.
And die.
When it stops being a potato.
I am really excited by a book that Fur Planet is putting out. It's called Gods with Fur, and it is an anthology focused on mythology around anthro creatures and the mythology that would develop around anthro creatures. So I think this, from a strictly HSD perspective, is an interesting tie-in with what mythologies might develop in a furry society. And I'm really hoping that we get a guest appearance by Zolocht, who is my very favorite anthro deity, even though he has no hair and he's not Anubis.
While it's perhaps a more morbid cool, one of the articles that I've been reading recently is that Tesla has been in the news a lot. The
really?
Auto-driving cars have had several fatalities, which is kind of a first for the self-driving cars, for the autopilot. But it's attracted a lot of attention. It's gained a lot of discussion. I think this is definitely relevant to HSD in that we have a much different gut check reaction to a fatality where an AI is in charge, as opposed to the multiple fatal car wrecks that are happening every minute, every hour, otherwise on the roads. But when an AI does it,
that's news.
We're talking about it. It's on the news. So
I guess that is because there's this notion that we expect machines to essentially be working perfectly. So when something messes up to that degree, you find the human error in it, even though it's not a human being involved anymore with it.
So to be human is to make mistakes?
That's what Kirk says.
I was trying to stay off the Star Trek a little bit here, but
oh, shameless here. I just like to say that I'm kind of sad that we didn't, in our discussion of cogs and ships, discuss a very important, empowered female character who is a cog in charge of a ship. Of course, Gypsy of Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Oh, yes!
The only one that knows what's going on and keeps track of everything, even if she does talk in a high, funny voice.
Well, I think that's all we have time for, even though we really don't technically have a time limit. That's all we have patience for. So I want to thank you all for braving the heartless vacuum of space and making it here.
No airlock incidents this time.
Yeah, thank you. We got the seals working again.
Sorry. So
we'll catch up with all of y'all in a few weeks and catch the outro line.
Intro music is Future Club and outro music is Chronicles, both by Serious Beat. This podcast is copyright 2016 by Radio Free Deimos and may be used in any not-for-profit project with appropriate credit and notification. Check out our website, radiofreedeimos.com, that's DEIMOS, for more rambling resources, links to official and Vandervid content, and our full catalog of episodes.